Hello, this is Dr. Heather Zwicky, and today we'll be mapping nutrition and Parkinson's on the 15-Minute Matrix.
Welcome to the 15-Minute Matrix. I'm Andrea Nakayama, functional medicine nutritionist and your host. This is the podcast that brings you bite-sized insights and lessons on how to use the most important tool in functional medicine and functional nutrition. Today, I'll be talking with Dr. Heather Zwicky. Heather is an immunologist who's been working to bridge the gap between conventional biomedicine and natural medicine. Heather was previously the Dean of Research and Graduate Studies at the National University of Natural Medicine. She studies natural approaches to inflammation, and her current research is focused on neuroinflammation and how nutrition and nutritional supplements can impact diseases such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. There's so much to cover with this brilliant woman, and I know you're going to gobble up her insights and wisdom, so let's begin. Welcome, Heather. I'm excited to have you here.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
So can you start us out by explaining what Parkinson's is, or what I like to call what's going on in there, and perhaps what antecedents and triggers might be at play when we're addressing Parkinson's?
Sure. So Parkinson's disease, most people think of as a movement disorder that is characterized by gait difficulty, so difficulty walking, a tremor. Often people lose their speech, they lose their sense of smell. And it's really thought to be caused by lack of dopamine. However, there's much more to it than that. So what we know right now is that it probably starts in the gut around 7 to 9 years prior to any of the first movement disorder symptoms. And then the gut inflammation, which really is neuroinflammation, goes up the vagus nerve, and you get deposits of what is called alpha-synuclein in the hypothalamus. And that's really what's causing the movement disorder. When we think about it in terms of antecedents and triggers, what we're really talking about is the concept of neuroinflammation, which is, I think, important to remember that it starts in the gut, because most people don't think about the fact that dopamine and serotonin and all these things that we think of in the brain are actually produced as much, if not more, in the gut.
Right. So then when we're thinking about it starting in the gut, and we're thinking about those neurohormones and their production in the gut, what kind of terrain or ecological environment does lead to the manifestation of those imbalances?
Well, so that's a really good question, and I think we're just starting to get to the answers. There was a really interesting study that came out a couple of years ago in 2015 by a group called Shepherdgens, and what they showed was that you see an undergrowth of a microbial species called Prevotella, which is one of your normal, healthy microbes in your gut. And when Prevotella starts dying, you see an overgrowth of E. coli. Mm-hmm. And correlating with the overgrowth of E. coli is gait difficulty. And what's interesting about that is then if you start killing off that E. coli with an antibiotic, actually the gait difficulty starts to repair itself a bit. So here we see a situation where the microflora imbalance is actually leading to a movement disorder. Now you say, okay, so what causes the microflora imbalance, right? So there's two different things that we know for sure are impacting the microflora imbalance. There are probably others, but at least these two things are causing microflora imbalance. The first one is something we all know and love and don't have enough of, and that is vitamin D. So we know that vitamin D deficiency will cause vitamin D controls the production of a protein in your gut called a defensin. And defensin is what controls overgrowth of different species. And so if your vitamin D is low, your E. coli can overgrow. If your vitamin D is normal, your E. coli doesn't overgrow. Now, that's only one piece, because we also know that somewhere around 80% of our population is vitamin D deficient, and they don't all have Parkinson's. So know that that's not the only thing there, right? But that's one of the things. The other thing that we know is playing a role is actually pesticides and herbicides in the environment. That seems to be what's killing the Prevotella. So people who are exposed to pesticides, herbicides, environmental toxicity, seem to have less Prevotella. It kills off their Prevotella, and now their E. coli overgrow, and that causes overproduction of this protein, alpha-synuclein, which then goes and deposits in the hypothalamus. So we know those pieces. We clearly don't know all the pieces yet, but those are some pretty important pieces, because they tell us some very key things we can do clinically with respect to eating organic and avoiding foods with pesticides and herbicides. But even more so, what we're seeing with the pesticides and herbicides is that it's not the foods so much that are the problem. It's the people who live in farming communities often will have pesticides and herbicides that have leached into the groundwater and into their drinking supply. So in those situations, really you're talking about, you know, buying bottled water or purifying water, right, or that sort of thing.
And I love this, Heather, because already you're bringing us into where diet and lifestyle intervention really do make an impact on clinical outcomes. So clearly you found that nutrition intervention mediates signs and symptoms related to Parkinson's. Can you speak a little bit into what made you so passionate about uncovering these connections that you're talking into?
I was formerly on the board and the nutritional advisory board for the Brian Grant Foundation, which is a local foundation here in Portland, Oregon, that serves Brian Grant, who is an NBA basketball player who developed Parkinson's. And one of the things that was really interesting to me when I was invited to sit on their scientific council was that Brian had managed to really control his Parkinson's with diet and exercise for 7 years. He'd gone on a vegetarian diet, and I'm not saying that vegetarian diets are good for all people with Parkinson's, but for a subset, it appears to be very good to switch to a vegetarian diet. And he was exercising every day, 7 days a week. And he wanted to know why it was working. And he wanted to know if it was advice that should be given to all people with Parkinson's. So we assembled this team to start looking at the literature with respect to nutrition and Parkinson's. And as I started uncovering different things, I realized that a lot of this was never making it to patients. And it wasn't even making it to neurologists, for that matter. It was in the nutrition literature, and nutritionists are typically not the people who are working with people with Parkinson's. And so if you asked a neurologist, does food make a difference, they'd tell you no. Uh-huh. And so I decided, with a little bit of activist in my nature, I decided that was going to be one of my goals, was to start educating people. And I have a skill of being able to take scientific literature and break it down into lay language so that patients can really understand what I'm saying and what I'm reading. And so I started there.
I love that about, I mean, Heather, I love that you're an activist. And I think, you know, one of the ways we first connected was that ability to break down that complex information and make it into the actionable. And what did you find? Like, what was the why, particularly about the vegetarian diet for some populations? What was the why behind that?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. Why the vegetarian diet works for some populations probably has to do, again, with the microflora, and that if you look at what makes different species of microflora grow, it's fiber. Mm-hmm. And so for certain individuals, they really benefit from going on a vegetarian diet where they increase their fiber in their diet significantly. What we're seeing is other people with Parkinson's actually benefit from a ketogenic diet where they're increasing fat. And those tend to be the folks who have too low of cholesterol in their brain. And or at least that's what we think. I mean, we haven't proven that, because you can't really take people's heads apart and look right at their cholesterol levels. But we do know that that a subset of people with Parkinson's, we've done a clinical trial now, we've shown that a subset of people, roughly a third of the people we studied, did much better on a ketogenic diet.
I love that you brought up the keto diet, because I was going to ask you about that. And I think, you know, the most therapeutic keto diets are high in fiber, and that we get there's a lot of misconceptions about what a therapeutic keto diet is. So it sounds like, you know, there is this combination of higher fat and making sure we get our fiber and our prebiotics that might create some balance for a person with Parkinson's.
Certainly that's true. Now, there's other things that are key for Parkinson's. So, for example, with Parkinson's, you don't want to have dairy. And the reason for that is twofold. One, dairy is one of our more polluted foods with pesticides and herbicides. We've known that since the 60s. It's all over the literature. And yet, it's not just that, because, again, you could go to organic dairy. However, dairy is also known to break down uric acid, and uric acid is protective for Parkinson's. It's a really strong antioxidant that your body makes. And so if you are now breaking down uric acid, that's no good. And in fact, uric acid is so protective that there's actually a drug in development that is a uric acid-based drug for Parkinson's. So no dairy. Well, now let's go back to that ketogenic diet. You know, the average ketogenic diet, if you aren't doing it well, it's chock full of dairy.
Exactly.
And so we had to design a ketogenic diet that was completely dairy-free and was organic and had high levels of vegetables. And, you know, I mean, it was a challenge for sure. But I have to tell you, anytime we're going to put a patient on a diet like that, we all do it ourselves first. And I have never felt so good. My brain was, I mean, just alive on a ketogenic diet. So, yeah. Now, interestingly, I told you only a third of people felt better. But if we looked at their Parkinson's scores, 100% of them actually got better. But then some of them didn't feel better. They walked better. They had less tremor, but they didn't feel better. And that's a key component. If they don't feel better, they're not going to stay on a diet like that.
Right. There is a high risk reward ratio here in terms of the effort that needs to be put in to do a diet like this. So in our do's and don'ts, which I wanted to ask you about in relation to nutrition, we have don't, we have dairy as a don't, we have, you know, pesticides and non-organic foods as a don't. And in our do's, we have vitamin D. Of course, that's a test don't guess arena. We have water purification so that we're looking at our individual water supply. What other do's and don'ts did you find to be some big mediators?
Sure. For this, I would go to Lori Mishley's data out of Bastyr University and University of Washington. And she has a cohort of people with Parkinson's she's been following. And what she finds is that people who are slow progressors, what they avoid are artificial sweeteners. Artificial sweeteners are neurotoxins. A lot of people don't realize that, but so don't do artificial sweeteners. But you also need to avoid high fructose corn syrup, and you need to avoid sugar. So if you're going to avoid those three sweeteners and you're on the standard American diet, what can you replace it with? What we see is actually fairly good for people with Parkinson's is maple syrup. Maple syrup tends to be better than honey or agave or any of the other sweeteners. No one's looked at stevia. I would imagine that it's also good, but avoiding high fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, and sugar for people with Parkinson's is important. And again, it's increasing neuroinflammation, so you don't want to use those things.
And is the maple syrup because of some of the nutrients that we're going to get from that, or is it just as the inflammatory sweeteners?
They actually see a positive effect with maple syrup. Yeah. So it's actually, there's a benefit there. So those are some don'ts. The other don't is, as you might guess, trans fat. you know, trans fat is, again, highly inflammatory. And if something's going to be inflammatory, it'll just increase neuroinflammation. Let's see, the other do's are pretty straightforward. You want to decrease oxidative stress. So you're going to do that with berries and nuts. And there are several studies that look at anthocyanins. So the darker the berry, the better. And then nuts, when we're talking the brain, really walnuts tend to be our best nut for the brain, but closely followed by macadamia nuts. Pistachios have lithium, so people with Parkinson's, because their dopamine is out of balance, that means their serotonin also gets out of balance, and that lithium helps bring that serotonin back into balance. So nuts and berries, super good. And as you can imagine, fish oil then, and fishes, really eating fatty fishes is good for them. But again, you want the fatty fishes that don't have the environmental toxicities.
It is a catch-22. It really comes down to a low inflammatory diet that's high in protective factors. And again, that fat, when we're eating the environmental toxins, the fat's going to contain the most environmental toxins in the dairy and the exactly. fish. So we want to really be careful about the sources we're recommending there. Super interesting. And the fiber for the gut, anything else that falls into a big do?
Green tea. In fact, there's been so many studies on green tea. There's even systematic reviews on green tea. Green tea looks like it can delay the onset of Parkinson's for up to 7 years.
That's amazing. It's my favorite. Yeah. I drink a matcha green tea every morning, so that makes me feel good.
Well, and you know, what I find when I talk to people with Parkinson's is a lot of them don't really like green tea, so I give them ways to disguise it. So I have them make green tea pesto, and I talk about green tea smoothies where they can disguise the green tea in something else if they're not a huge green tea fan. But, you know, coffee also works for Parkinson's. It's not just the caffeine in the green tea and the coffee. We think it's actually the quercetin in coffee. The problem with coffee and green tea is that it will often, you know, increase your urination. And right. if you have a movement disorder, increasing urination can be problematic because getting to a restroom takes you a lot longer. So, you know, again, we always have to consider the balance here.
So you mentioned that nutritionists aren't typically people who are working with people with Parkinson's. And I just want to applaud the work you're doing and say that that really needs to change, because even though people with Parkinson's are getting medical intervention, there is a tremendous amount of work that we as nutritionists, as functional nutrition and lifestyle practitioners can do to help with both prevention and reversing signs and symptoms based on what you're sharing with us today.
It's so true. And, you know, I get this all the time. I speak all over the country and Europe and Canada, and I'll finish my talk and people will say, who here can I go to help me with this? And the answer is there's so few people who know.
And that's where Functional Nutrition Lab comes in. So, exactly. you know, really partnering with graduates of the practitioner training division of the Functional Nutrition Alliance, they know their stuff. They know how to think about the body and the physiology, and they're going to eat this conversation up, Heather. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us.
You're very welcome.
The 15-Minute Matrix is brought to you by me, Andrea Nakayama, and the Functional Nutrition Alliance. The 15-Minute Matrix team includes my son, Gilbert Nakayama, on sound production, Renee Hunt, Natalie Merrill, and Christine Shook. You can visit us and hear more episodes at www.15minutematrix.com. That's www.15minutematrix.com. And if you'd like to get my therapeutic diet matrix and be notified each time there's a new podcast episode, please go to www.15minutematrix.com/diets. And if you're interested in being a student or graduate of the Practitioner Training Division of the Functional Nutrition Alliance, previously called Holistic Nutrition Lab, you'll now find us at Functional Nutrition Lab. you can go to www.functionalnutritionlab.com to learn more, because the doors to the class of 2018 are now open. And I want to invite you to email us about the podcast. Tell us what you think. And let me know who you'd like to hear on the 15-Minute Matrix and what topics you'd like to see mapped. You can always email us at ask@15minutematrix.com. I can't wait to hear from you.